when I started off.
Found this would be nice.
All right, well, I'll just have a bit of a bash. I started off by telling these people that I was born at Langland in 1922. Yep. In a hospital that was on the corner of Edward Street and Main Street.
Mm-hmm.
The building is still there, little square building, long, long since decommissioned as a hospital. And of course, Langland has changed enormously. Anyway, that was 1922, the same year that the railway line was built from Cooer up to Strzelecki.
Mm-hmm.
My first school experiences were at the Recreation Reserve in Kapani. I would have been 4 and a half, I suppose, so that would be 1927. I went to the Recreation Reserve school for a very brief time. I remember a Miss Silverthorne and a Miss Dwyer were two consecutive teachers. Then a new school, 4154, was built down on the intersection of Taplin's Road, that's the road that runs up into the, becomes the main street of Kapani, and the Coor up Long Worry Road. And I attended that school to merit level, then went to Langland for a year chasing a scholarship, fruitless, hopeless exercise, but never mind. And then spent many years after that in the first technical schools in Melbourne, and etc., etc. Now, when my mother's family first went to live in Catania, that was in 1908, and Grandfather Bennett selected two blocks on Scanlon's Drain Road, and Mother and the three sisters were girls, and they had to go to school at Yennefin, 3 miles away, and it must have been a shocking business because the roads were virtually impassable fogs. Remember, this is a peat swamp, a description of people's raw acid humus. It was reeds, or technical term I think for mispragmatis, not sure about that, but reeds and scrub and water and stumps and whatever. Very, very raw country. Well, until some drainage occurred in the winter time, it was usually put to 2 feet deep in water.
Mm-hmm.
In the summers, of course, it used to dry out a certain amount. Anyway, eventually the drainage system, and that's a story all on its own, was instituted to the level where, in, I think it was about 1897, the Land Department threw some of this land open to selection, and that's when Grandfather Bennett, who lived up on the Murray till that time, had to come down and have a look at some of it and selected these two blocks.
Is Bennett your mother's family?
My mother's,
name?
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. And they originally, I think, Grandfather Bennett's father came from Cornwall, England. My father was a Patello, and he was a descendant of David Patello, who came out in 1854 to Craigieburn, married a lady called Agnes Patton, had 18 children. My grandfather Tom was one of those kids, and he had 11 children. My father was one of those. They're all gone now. Yeah? And father had three boys. My brother Jack, who's been dead for 20 odd years, and myself, my younger brother, who still lives in Maryland. Anyway, that's just part of us, I suppose.
Mm.
So I lived away from Kapani from the time I was 12 to 26.
While you were schooling in
Melbourne? Well, I went to school for a time, and then I worked in the Newport Power Station.
Mm-hmm.
During the war years, I became the senior technical assistant there. And about a year after the war ended, I had a bit of a breakdown, and it wasn't until about 10 years ago that it was determined that I've got a small hole in my heart, which causes atrial fibrillation, uneven heart rhythm, and some blood pressure. However, that's been controlled, and the specialist cardiologist kicked me out and says, we know your problem, you've got a structural defect, never any different. Your own doctor will happily prescribe your medicine, and it's, and so I've been staggering along, enjoying life. But it was at that point that I resigned from the Electricity Commission and went back to farming.
Yeah.
And I spent over 30 years then in Japan, until about, must be nearly 19 years ago, I retired, and Patty and I bought this place and rebuilt it. But it was short and square, but originally owned by the Pacman Shire engineer, Ron Chambers, way back. And it would have been a World Service home, but it used to finish at the edge of that window. And that wall there, just the other side of where the crystal cabinet is, and none of this was there. I put a great slab right down the back and on this end, you see, and made it. It's now quite a comfortable home. I bought it because it had all the services on it, including gas. And that meant that those oldies could have gas or electric cooking, etc., etc. Anyway, that's diverting away from the story a little bit, perhaps. You can edit out whatever you like for the subject. Or we can redo it.
You can just chat merrily, that's fine.
Is that right?
Now, for the record, you were talking about the Second World War before, weren't you?
Yes, I was.
Just so after this morning.
Yes, of course.
And you were born in what year?
1922.
So you have that sense of perspective there. Can you tell us a bit more about general community life when you were growing up? I know you were saying that you only did it until you were 12. But what sorts of things?
Yes, I can tell you quite a deal about it. For instance, as a boy, I was born in 22, so I was 8 when the Depression of the 30s hit us. I lived in a rich family. We had very, very little, but I never ever went to bed hungry, and I never went to bed cold, and I never ever knew my mother and father to have a cross word between them. They might have some very slight words, but not a serious cross word. I slept on a veranda by choice, not necessity. Top covering on my bed was a Wagga blanket, and the Wagga blanket is 3 new potato sacks sewn together, quite warm. An iron roof of a veranda drips with condensation when you have a heavy frost. And it just takes an enormous amount of water to get through a Wagga blanket, so the body underneath it never, ever got damp.
Yeah.
And it was a good fresh air. Yeah. And the veranda was enclosed, mind you. Largely enclosed. I just thought we were wealthy because of that circumstance in a time of enormous difficulty. Yeah. And I wasn't old enough to have the worries of finance. I guess father and mother must have had tough times, because I can remember seeing one of mother's grocery account, and this would be hard groceries, I suppose, for 7 shillings and 6 pence for a fortnight. Mm-hmm. Now, I know money terms are very different, but it wasn't a lot of money. The farmhouse had an orchard in the corner of the drive, and there were Gravenstein apples and yates and pears and peaches, probably, and I'm not sure what else. And I used to wonder why anybody would plant a yate apple. They're a little tough, hard apple, but eventually I got round to realising that they probably keep as good as golf balls almost, and that orchard was an important part of their food chain in those days. And I think my forebears lived mostly on dairy produce and vegetables they grew themselves, plus preserves from the orchard and jams and that sort of thing. Not a lot of meat, and not a great deal of poultry, because poultry wasn't like today. Poultry came out of the poultry run, and if you ate too much, there were no eggs. So, and we used to grow geese for Christmas dinners. Alcohol was almost absent. At Christmas time, Father would buy half a dozen bottles, large bottles of beer. I suppose they were the Christmas celebration, and there was always probably some brandy and some port wine in the medicine chest, in case somebody ran into an accident, just as a little bit of a steady.
Where exactly was this farming property?
The property was on Scanlon's Drone Road, Japani. I can show you on a subdivision later.
Is the home still there?
No. I'm a bit of a traitor. My girls would have been fifth generation, but there were no farmers left, so that's why I sold the farm in 81. The old original house was pulled down not many years ago. It was built in 1916. I could possibly find a picture of it, I'm not sure. It was pulled down only a few years ago. I built for Paddy and I fairly close to the old home. At that stage, Brother Jack was on a soldier farm at Jimbra. Brother Wing was on the farm next door. And just the oldies and Farrell and I ran a partnership for a time, and I built a home for Paddy and I. Oh, you could put another home in between, I suppose, you know, a big block in between. And that house still exists, and that is the farmhouse now.
And was the previous house a weatherboard house?
Yes, it was. Yeah. And so is the existing one. The original one was on stumps cut out of the local timber, which of course eventually Robert Mill had to be re-blocked. The current one was on concrete stumps set on the clay line. And I built it in 1953, and the doors closed, well, when I left it, the doors closed exactly the same. That was 81. Well, it's probably built on a proper foundation. Nowadays, they build most houses on slabs, I guess, concrete slab. But anyway, that was it. My house was about 16 squares, I think, in the finish, and we had a lot of very happy years in it. And the old house is gone, and the buildings have changed very dramatically, and the people who own it now, oh, they farm much the same. They grow potatoes on part of it, and dairy on part of it, and it's all on this beautiful peak country, which is very easy to cultivate. And they put a dam on it. It responds to wet years, provided the drainage is good. This peak's just fibre root material, just wet down. You probably know more about that than I do. Anyway, of course, we had no electricity until 1937. Up till then, it was candles or an Aladdin lamp, which is a, if you've ever heard of those, but they're a kerosene lamp, have a tall glass mantle, and then a shade that comes down and out like this, throw a lovely soft light. But if you put the Latin in the middle of the dining table, you've all got to sit down if you want to read, and it doesn't light a whole room. And then we had a Gloria petrol light system. Out on one of the verandas, there was a cylinder which you filled up with shellite or that type of material, pumped up the pressure, and then went in and primed and then lit a mantle, just like a gas lamp. And the rooms in the home had these little fine tubes run all through the ceiling from that, and these gas lamps, which are a very nice soft lamp, ran into trouble on summer evenings if there were any moths about or insects, because they would fly into them and break the mantle. And have a bit of a job replacing mantles. And then in 1937, Upland Courier Up had run on its own power plant, and the State Electricity Commission took over, and they connected Courier Up to the supply and to Lang Lang and the parts of Yamathan and the Camerons, that's Ross people. They were instrumental in persuading enough people in the Kapani area to guarantee to use enough electricity so that the Electricity Commission would make a connection. They had to guarantee to use about £12 or £15 worth in a year. And they'd got up the stage, they needed one more, and there was a Mr. Coghlan who lived on O'Shea's Road, and Coggy didn't think he needed it. And they had to go back and visit him four or five times before they eventually persuaded him. And once they had him, then they could go to the commission. And we got power on 37. And yet over on the north side of Kapani, they didn't get it on until 1954, because the war came along soon after 37. All that sort of work stopped, and after the war there was such a shortage of materials for a dashed long time, so nothing happened for that big interval. Right, now, where would you like to go next? A bit more on education?
Some family saw people, faces that might stand out from the region, shop owners or nearby neighbours.
Well, yes. Our nearest neighbours were the Camerons, who lived opposite. This was Paddy's father, actually, and they had two blocks of land too, right opposite ours, on the north side of Scanlon's Drain, where ours were between, on the south side between Scanlon's Drain and the number 6 train, which is the main drain running from Bales right away up to Mandela, due east virtually. Pop Cameron cleared those blocks by hand power. If they put up a fence, they floated the posts down the drains when the drains were dug sufficiently, and then they pointed them and stuck them in the ground and hammered them in. They couldn't dig a hole in that sort of soup, you see, so that's how they formed the boundary fences. One day he got lost on that farm, about 160 acres, that's about, oh, 200, yeah. I'm just trying to work that out. I think in total it would have been about 3/4 mile in one dimension and 1/2 mile the other way. Anyway, he's working down the back and the light started to fade and he couldn't find his way back to the hut, which was up on a bit of dry, high ground. So he spent a very miserable night in the tea tree and rubbish and whatever. The next day, when he eventually found his way out, he put up the longest pole he could find up beside the hut, and when it got late afternoon, he always kept the pole in sight, so he didn't have to put in another night.
Down in the sh-
oh, yeah.
Quite wise.
And that, because it was a swamp, that was heaps of snakes there. I'd red-bellied black snakes and copperheads, but mostly tiger snakes, I suppose on a proportion of nearly 20 to 1 tigers against anything else. Killed a few of them at odd times. Actually fiddled on one accidentally one day. Well, when one of my daughters got older and went to school at the William Angus College, and the family that she stayed with in town, she had to stay over, the husband and the son were keen shooters. And they came down one afternoon, they were going to shoot some rabbits. So I drove them down to the back of the farm where the number 6 drain had been dug, and we pulled in onto what had been the old railway embankment. And I stopped, and they got their gun cases out to get their very handsome guns out and assemble them. And I thought, well, this is a good opportunity, I'll just relieve myself, and I'm looking over my shoulder talking to them when I hear a rustle and look down and I'm feeling a tiger snake. Fortunately, he's taken off up the bank. If he'd come my way, I don't know how to explain that to Paddy.
No.
But anyway, it's like years ago, almost down the same area, Grandfather Bennett had a fellow crawling parrots, down on your knees, weeding, it's called. When Grandfather Bennett went down to see what had happened, a dash little work had been done, and this workman said, "Oh, Mr. Bennett, I'm on my knees crawling along, and the snake crawled up the leg of my trousers, and I just had to lie down until the snake crawled out again." And Grandfather Bennett said, well, you can crawl off my farm, thanks. Well, look, Jolly Rich had gone down there asleep, you see, and made out this little fabrication. But, there were a few occasions like that. My little brother Jack and I killed a fairly big tiger snake. We were off to Sunday school. Instead of going around the road, we went down through the paddocks. We had a piece of fencing wire each, and we encountered a fairly large snake. And after a lot of swishes, we eventually did him. And we scrambled him up and we dragged him home. And we
didn't, show and tell.
Yeah, no, I think we didn't get into trouble for not doing what we were told, because Father probably thought, well, these guys might have, having dealt with that fairly big snake, they might be a little more secure if they encamped another one.
Yeah.
But that's snakes anyway, in the swamp.
So
there you go. See, that's probably.
What about the town itself? It's general store.
Yeah, well, as I remember the town itself, all the blocks in the town are built up now, and that's 12 houses.
Mm.
But originally, I think, before my time, there was a store there, and then the railway came along in 1922, and when the railway came along, the store was built down on the edge of one of the access roads, the front of the store under the access road, and the back of it almost into the station yard. And that store was owned by a fella called Les Curry.
Mm-hmm.
Curry had a store out in Yannathan, which was the hub of Yannathan, and Les had that store for a good many years, and then he sold it to a fellow, as far as I can remember, called Nothing. And this AC, nothing, whatever the AC was, I don't know, but nothing ran that store. And of course it was very convenient to the station for goods. Until one morning, as a small boy, I can remember looking down to the south from the farm, and there was a pretty big conflagration, and that Mr. Nothing store disappearing in flames. And a local motor transport operator called Bill Corbin had, he had his truck, I couldn't tell you what sort of a truck, but he had his truck down at the store at the time, and whether he wasn't there or whether he got his truck out, but his truck wasn't burnt anyway. Now after that store was burnt down, the store was then moved up into the main street, and it was the last building closest to where the railway line used to run. The railway station itself in the very early days had a station mistress, I think, and the husband, her name was Gibb, Mrs. Gibb, and I think the husband, if I remember, he was Bill Gibb, he was the ganger or looked after a section of the permanent way. He had one of these hand trolley gadgets, looked like dashed hard work, particularly if you're going into a headwind, but you know, it looked like a fun affair to a little bloke who didn't have to pedal it. And there was a platform that had a small waiting room on it. And in the morning the milk train used to come clattering down from, I don't know how far it ran, at least up to Yarnton or Heath Hill probably. It would come bowling down into Catanium, and everybody took their milk down in spring carts. You know, a spring cart is, it's like a light or a dray. It's a light cart that would carry half a tonne, so it would make it a little not maybe a tonne. And you could trot along at a fair pace. It was about a mile and a quarter, or maybe a little bit more, from our place down to the station. And when that milk train came in, there'd be spring carts jostling in all directions to get into position, and milk was all in cans. Called 40s or 50s, a 40 quart can was 10 gallons and a 50 was 12.5. And they shuffle all these cans into van trucks, and there'd be one passenger carriage in case the passengers came aboard, and there'd be a screech of a whistle and the whole thing would zoom off, and the station yard would fall back into virtual peace till the next day. Except in the potato season, and on the opposite, there was a siding, and the siding had a platform, and a weighbridge was there, and there was some type of loading affair. And when the potato season was running, they would take their potatoes down in sacks, 15 to the tonne, approximately. Take them down and be met by either Mr. Carl MacDonald or Mr. Bill Miles. They were the two potato agents. If potatoes were pretty valuable, they'd be vying with each other to see how they could make the sale. See, you'd go over the weighbridge, they'd make the sale, you'd unload your potatoes, put the gear over the weighbridge again, so you got your potato weight, they'd be unloaded, and then they would then trolley them over and load them into these railway trucks and tarp them down, and they'd be ready for the next train out. There was nothing else. There was a recreation reserve in Catania, just facing the main street, and it's still there. In those days, or in early days, it was the Amerton Recreation Reserve. But after the railway went through, and Catania then got its name, and the station was named Catania after Carlo Catania, of course, drainage engineer. And then the Amerton Recreation Reserve eventually became the Catania Recreation Reserve. It's quite surprising. That's another. I was there the other day, and I was there, and I hadn't been there for years.
Yes, you said
tell you a bit more about that record. Yeah. Now, in the main street, in about 1931 or two or three, I think husband and wife, Paul Simpsons, gave £250 toward the church, and a Presbyterian church was built up at the top end. Many years later, another church was built. One of the more modern churches. I can't tell you the name of it, I should know, halfway down. In about 1926 to 7, a soldiers' memorial hall was built. And there were two tennis courts put up, I can't remember just how long since. And this recreation reserve, and they used to have sports meetings on New Year's Day. One stage they had a trotting track, much bigger, around the outside of the thing. And And that New Year's Day sports ran for I don't know how many years, and eventually it conked out, and then the major New Year's Day sporting affair used to be up at Long Warry, and they had, as I remember that, there was largely wood chops and bicycle races. I only went there two or three times, I suppose, and I don't really remember the New Year's Day sports that funny at all. In much more recent times, they had a very strong scouting organisation, and they had their own scout hall. I noticed that's gone, and I don't know why. The tennis courts that were there, we rebuilt those, but that would be in the early 50s, and now there are four tennis courts. When I say we rebuilt them, they used to be subject to water trouble, so we put big rock drains all around, and then put 100 cubic metres of white sand out of a sand pit up in South Yamerton on it, and made two very good courts. And then later, I think, with Council Hill, they built another piece. So they've got four excellent courts. They play night tennis on them. They look. The Recreation Reserve, we also had a go at that. This has gone back to the 50s. It used to be a saucer. We were able to raise some money and arrange a contract and had all the topsoil removed and the saucer inverted and then the topsoil put back on it. And we finished up enough money to resell it and to put some cyclone fence around part of it. And since then, in the last years, they've built a most excellent pavilion change rooms. Part of it is carpeted, excellent kitchen on it. Tiled area that's got a bar facility, and then the area where they had all the display, I didn't take particular notice, but it's quite a big building. I called it the Taj Mahal when I saw it the other day.
Right.
And on the end of it, a gymnasium, a well-equipped gymnasium. And they have, I understand they run three football teams and a couple of littlies. 100 footballers play football in the season. And the same three cricket teams, and then an under 14 and an under 12, four tennis teams, six netball teams. I don't know what they play back in the hall. I was in the hall. I've never seen it in better order. The local hall committee, they've done a marvellous job. It all looked fresh and clean and nice, and so many of those places become dilapidated. And the little church, even inside. Immaculate, except it had a couple of small windows broken. First bit of vandalism they've had. Outside was a wee bit shabby, but it's lined up. They're going to start repainting it almost immediately. And the whole of the sports facility was in absolutely excellent order. I saw no sign of graffiti on any of it. And in this day and age, I think that's quite surprising.
It's tremendous.
The committee told me that they orient most of their stuff towards family. I think they get lots of people come in to play in the various sports there because for that reason, rather than being necessarily just fiercely competitive or competitive at all costs, they tend to encourage family affairs, and that I think that keeps excessive drinking and they control it and all that down. Obviously, they run it very well. I was just amazed, and it was in such good order.
Do you think that sport has always been a large part of Katani life? It's obviously grown.
I think it has been in country life. It's the same thing as, I don't suppose it is now, but when we were young people, dancing, of course, ballroom dancing was, nowadays, this is my comment and you can disagree with this, nowadays you ask a girl to dance with you and you hop up and jump around, and as long as you finish up in the same room when the music stops, you dance together. Where in our days, you put your arm around the girl, it seemed to be a lot more romantic, and you danced on a floor that was fast but not slippery.
Yeah.
And, you danced the quick step or the modern waltz or the foxtrot or the slow foxtrot or whatever it happened to be.
A lot of these dances must have been held at the Katani Hall.
Well, they were originally. If you go right back into early history, Yanathan, because it was all on higher ground, was Debelsheds. It's on the south edge of the swamp. It's not true swampland at all, not in the same sense anyway. And the Yanathan store was Well, so the Yonathan Hall and the Union Church, which provided for three denominations of church, were in one position. Curry Store is about a mile down the road. The Yonathan School was another mile and a half further on. When the station ultimately got built, it was about 2 miles back the other way from the store, and the recreation reserve was another 2.5 miles away, so Yonathan was almost a district rather than a little township, where when Katani, once the railway went in, and that little main street of Katani had a row of houses, and then the recreation reserve and the hall and the church were almost as though they were on the other side of it, and it still exists that way. So it was a centre that Yonathan never ever was. But going right back to the very early days, in entertainment, before Katani existed, Yonathan was the centre. There was a wattle club formed by some of the young ladies and her mother and her sisters, and the Curry girls, the storekeepers, there were four of them, and some others formed this wattle club. And the event of the year was the Bachelor and Spinsters Ball, which got going about